From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We're joined, as always, with our super producer, Paul Mission Control Deccant. Most importantly, you are you, you are here, and that makes this the stuff they don't want you to know. Oh, well, it's been a pretty interesting couple of weeks for us over here, fellow conspiracy realists. Our collective day-to-day has been kind of like a never-ending action montage. And for many of us listening today, the modern world is one example of that. Sometimes it feels like you never get a break, despite what the Kit Kat commercials would have you believe. And there's never enough time to do the things you want to do or to do the things you need to do. You know, we've got a lot of people with kids in the audience today. Matt, Noel, you both are fathers yourselves. And do you ever get to a point where you're like, I gotta feed this kid. I gotta do something. Who's gonna, you know, but I also have to do these other 12 things before I cook.
Yep, I call that nug time.
Well, yeah, and it really is a problem because as a parent, you want to feed your child the healthiest thing you possibly can, but that takes time. A lot of the time.
Oh, God. No, that's accurate, Matt. But not only that, like, I don't know if a lot of non-parents out there know this, but kids are very picky eaters. And my kid's diet consists largely of things that I hide in spaghetti. And spaghetti and chicken nuggets. Try to get the organic ones, you know, from the store, but occasionally we'll go for those, you know, weird molded McDonald's nugs, which I think are delicious, but there's a whole lot to that.
Yeah, and there's a whole lot to those nuggets specifically. We have a poultry episode in the future, don't we? But this is something that doesn't just apply to those of us in the audience who have children. This applies to everybody who lives in most of modern society. I mean, consider that post-industrial age, people have regimented lunch breaks, right? If they're lucky enough to have a lunch break at all. And that means that at some point you'll have, what, 30 minutes to eat? And if you are like many, many people, that's just enough time to run to the closest, fastest thing and, you know, that sells stuff to shove in your mouth, shove that in your mouth, and then maybe use the restroom and wash your hands before you go back to making widgets. And then you have the alternative, which is you could take out of your free time another, 20, 30 minutes, whatever, to make yourself something to brown bag into work. What we're saying is that people have historically felt like there were not enough hours in the day at some point. And this has only accelerated in the modern age, which is, if you're listening to this podcast when it comes out, or if you're listening to it hundreds of years from now, we hope it doesn't sound silly when we call this the modern age. But that's where we're at, 2021. Since ancient times, human beings have been searching for more convenient solutions to this problem of time in terms of like the necessities people have to satisfy every 24 hours. Food is no exception. And that is why today, fellow conspiracy realist, we are talking about fast food. Here are the facts, and this is also, by the way, a side plug for our weekly Strange News segment.
Yeah, recently we talked about a new installation of sorts, an historical installation that's going to be available for tourists in Pompeii. It's just a great example of an early fast food-like store or a stall, right? Where you could quickly go up to a counter, get what you needed in food form, and then take it away. And it was just fascinating for us to look at that. Something that exists for us right now still existed 2,000 years ago, not in exactly the same form, but in a similar enough way that we could recognize it easily. And it made us think about the future for sure.
Yeah. Thermopolium, I think it was called, right? A hot food and drink shop. That was the one where if the wine was tasting off, they had these fermented fava beans they would throw in. So people were still trying to get over on each other even back then.
You know, one thing this reminds me of, too, in terms of fast food is something that we've come across in our other show, Ben, Ridiculous History. There was something, I think it was called, like, Forever Stew, where, like, taverns would literally just have this constant boiling pot of whatever, and they would just add to it, and it never depleted. They would just keep putting garbage into it, and people would just get a ladle of it when they'd come in and stay for the night. But it like literally was just out all the time. And that's, you know, not too far off for what's done in fast food restaurants. I mean, okay, obviously there are more sanitary conditions and protocols and all of that. But, you know, it's the same deal with if you think about like the burgers that stay out under those heat lamps, you know, all day, or the nugs that stay in those like giant bins or those trays and those like racks.
Yeah, and it's really interesting, you guys. Yeah, I see exactly what you're saying there, Noel. I just was trying to visualize this, Ben, and I want to put this out there to see what you think about this picture I want to paint. Because we're really talking about as humans go from gathered somewhere in a small, even a village, like before a village, a very small amount of area covered by the group of humans living in one place. And the food sources are usually right outside of that area, or even within, contained within in some places, or if you got, you know, cattle or sheep or chickens or whatever you're keeping. As humans develop into more and more dense living conditions, right, with industrialization, these kinds of things, the food sources are pushed further and further from the center of where the humans are gathering, right? So then you have to have that food source kind of pushed, it has to come into the city, into the village, into the town, the castle, whatever it is. And that's why you need these places like that stall in Pompeii, where the food is now available in here, but it's not in the same form that it was when it was, you know, where it's originating, in that more raw form.
Yeah, you nailed it, Matt. That's very well said. First, also, Noel, you're right about the stew. And if we're going to be optimistic, we have to say that statistically, you know, food, sanitation aside, right? Hygiene aside, there had to be at least a few moments where that stew was unexpectedly the bomb. You know, it was fire.
Oh, no doubt. Everybody loves a good stew. It reminds me of Carl Weathers in Arrested Development, where he saves the bone from his chicken. And then he says, look, you take this, you put it in a pot of hot water, you got yourself a stew going.
Mm-hmm. I do that. You know? Yeah. But yes, you guys are absolutely right. Because there is something that the stew and the transportation problem have in common, which is something must be kept edible somehow. So when we're talking about this transportation problem starting shortly after human beings start adapting stationary lifestyles, meaning no longer nomadic, hunter gathering, but now it's like, hey, we're farming stuff. We could just stay here and build things and live in them. This is the beginning of urban development. And that's really the beginning of fast food as we know it today. The related to each other the same way that maybe a T-Rex is related to a chicken. There's a lot in between. But like you're saying, Matt, you're living in a city, whether an ancient city or a city today. And if you're like the majority of human beings today, you live in an urban area. You are running into the same problem as the ancient Romans, as people in the ancient Middle East, ancient China, which is you have less personal space. And that has become accelerated in huge metro areas like Tokyo. You probably aren't going to have room to raise your own chickens or grow your own rutabagas. There's also less room to prepare food in your average domicile or house. And there's a lot at stake with that, STAKE. Because, you know, if you're cooking in a really small area and it's not ventilated, you're frying something in oil, et cetera, et cetera. If something goes wrong, you could have a smell that stinks up the whole apartment building, like a macrocosmic level of the old, what's the thing people complain about in office working situation? Microwaving seafood. Mm-hmm. It's like that, but now it's everybody's house. Or you could accidentally burn that structure down. And of course, like you were saying, Matt, people lived in cities far, far before the Industrial Revolution. Ancient Rome actually had these cramped multi-story apartments where these people, the people living in them, did visit food stalls constantly. It was like a daily thing because what are you going to do? You're not going to cook it. You're not going to grow those beans. You got room to make wine in your squat?
Exactly. And that's the thing too, Ben. I think me and you in particular, Matt, I know that you also like to cook, but we sometimes take for granted that some people either don't have the time or the interest or the wherewithal to cook or learn to cook, or they're just plain not good at it. So I've definitely met people who are just mystified by cooking and just literally eat all of their meals in prepackaged form or out. And then if out is your thing, then oftentimes you're not going to always be able to do a sit down meal for, you know, lunch breaks, for example. So you are going to end up doing fast food quite often. And it's very much become part of this kind of like, you know, rat racy kind of American lifestyle.
But it's also become a big part of, at least recently, since the pandemic, choosing not necessarily fast food, but choosing to eat food from a prepared restaurant or a fast food chain right near you is a way of supporting your own community in a cool way, I would say.
And then everybody got into baking, right?
Right. Making bread.
It is a very good point. And you can make a point, if you want to be a little more philosophical about it, you can make a point about mindfulness, right? And how we approach the necessities of life. Because you can talk about people cooking their own food, but we know that with some exceptions, a lot of folks you probably know aren't making their own clothes. They're not building their own houses. You know what I mean? So where is the line of the mindfulness versus the convenience versus the investment? The idea of buying food for a purpose, also philosophical, right, to support one's community, is not new, but it definitely encountered a resurgence here in Atlanta for sure, but in many places throughout the U.S. Matt, I think you're specifically talking about when a local restaurant that usually had people come in and eat would sell, like, here is a prepackaged family meal for four people, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like just that. Exactly. But really, it's from where the food's originating to where it ends up to that stew to how we're supporting our local communities is really interesting how this thing, food, and how to get it quickly to yourself and your family, just everything touches it.
Or destroying your local community. So, so long story short, cities were around way before the Industrial Revolution. People who lived in those cities, which were all across the world, you know, on the continent of Africa and the continent of Asia, over in Western Europe, parts of the Middle East, people who lived in these dense urban agglomerations had access to pre-made foods from stalls and vendors. These were not apartment buildings where everybody was like growing their own stuff and only eating that. That is silly. So basically street food. Street food has been around for a long time. So fast food may be fast, but it is not new. The emergence, though, of what we call modern fast food is tied one-to-one with the Industrial Revolution, and in the U.S. very much to World War II is when we see a huge takeoff. And I propose that we take a moment for a word from our sponsors, and we'll return with more on the history of fast food and its troubling future. We are back. The evolution of fast food. This, you can trace it in a couple of different ways. First, there's the idea of what is called the self-serve restaurant. The first of these, Noel, since you were once upon a time a small German boy, could you help us out with that?
Let's see. Stahlwerk Automaten Restaurant.
Nailed it. Nailed it. So that's an automat. That's mm-hmm. what they would call it in the U.S., right? That was in Berlin in 1896, the very first one. And you guys, can we briefly describe an automat?
I literally have no idea what this is.
Yeah, you do, Matt. It's sort of like a retro, futuristic kind of form of like, you know, a restaurant where you have either a conveyor belt situation that's feeding some kind of grab and go type situation, right? Or it's these little windows where you put in a buck and then you open the window and you pull out the sandwich or the piece of pie. The modern equivalent to us here would maybe be that Kura Sushi franchise that they have out in an area here in Atlanta called Buford Highway, where it is literally a conveyor belt with different plates of sushi that come around and you grab the one you want, and then you are charged based on the plates that you feed into this little dispenser. So it's a very you get prizes. You got to get the prizes, and there's like a little animated character that does cool things the more you get. It's an interesting concept, and it does feel like at the time they were like, this is the wave of the future. But I'm sure those sandwiches would sit in there for quite some time, probably not under the best refrigeration conditions. And I bet you they were kind of gross, unless you had like people constantly refreshing them and hanging out behind the scenes. That's just my theory.
I eat gas station sandwiches all the time when I'm on the road.
That's exactly, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So all you do is like in the beginning, you put in your nickel or quarter or whatever your inflation rate is, and then you would push the button and you'd open the little glass window
yeah.
and you'd be like, oh, here's my piece of pie. I'm so lonely or whatever you say at a place like that. Dark City has a great example. I just wanted to plug Dark City.
Yeah, totally. It reminds me of the modern full equivalent to that is in the airport. They've got a lot of these stations where it's just like you're talking about at a convenience store where there's a bunch of sandwiches that you just grab one and you pay for it right there. But that's it. That's literally the transaction, is you grab it and you pay for it.
Yeah. So that's one of the evolutions of modern fast food. But there's the other idea, of a fast food outlet the way we understand them today. I'm in a hurry. I got to go to work. My kid won't be quiet, and they only eat one of three things. So I've got to zip in, zip out of this place. It's not going to be like a restaurant. I don't have to sit down. I don't have to, you know, contemplate a menu. What will be the appetizer? What will be dessert? What are the specials? Could you tell me about a little more about this tomato confit? No. I'm going to go up to this counter. I'm probably going to have, like, a numbered list of things I can pick from, right? A combo meal or a set. This is what we think of when we think of modern fast food. And you'll often hear people call White Castle the first fast food outlet. It began in Wichita, Kansas, 1916, as a bunch of like hamburger stalls. Hamburgers are still, by the way, the number one like most consumed fast food. And then it was officially founded as White Castle in 1921. Selling burgers at this point was not a big deal. You know what I mean? Like they weren't the first people to to do the moon landing equivalent here. They weren't the first people serving hamburgers, but what they were was the first people standardizing absolutely everything. First time in history, you go from one White Castle to the next. They did their best to make them indistinguishable.
Yeah, and that's the thing about fast food and the whole franchise, the scaling, rather, is what you would refer to this as. Like, the larger the company is, the more important it is that their practices be identical and that their hours be predictable and that it be something that everyone knows no matter which insert fast food chain X here you go to in whatever part of the country or even the world. Well, in the world, there are going to be some smaller changes in terms of like the types of menu items. There might be some like regional things available in certain, you know, spots. But in general, it's all about that predictability and that ritualization of going to your fast food chain of choice and knowing exactly what you're going to get.
Yeah, the chain, I think, is the most important word there, right? Because really what White Castle did, what all of these fast food companies do, is they build a supply chain where they're getting everything from. And it's because it's not just the meat. It's not standardized meat or, you know, whatever that is that goes inside. It's the buns. It's the equipment that's used to make those things, right? To cut the French fries or to get the French fries already cut in a factory somewhere. It's how all of that stuff moves into each individual outlet that becomes standardized.
Yeah, yeah. It's the paper products, right? It's the uniforms. It's the predictability of the hours. And that's strange because there's an anonymization of this. You know, the person at that counter could be any is every person. It's very different from the idea, the prevailing idea of local restaurants at the time, where there would be like, I always know that Thelma or Janice or Ernie or Oscar is going to be at the counter, and they always know how I like my coffee and burger, whatever. They eat a coffee and a burger at the same time.
For me, that's the diner experience. And maybe I just have a soft spot in my heart for it, but like somebody you know that knows what you like, and it's still a pretty fast turnaround for food, but it's way more, the being anonymized like that. You are no longer a human being who knows my stuff. You just as a company know what I like, and all I have to do is say a number and then say, make it a large.
Yeah, I like a restaurant where they treat me like a meme, you know, where like the door dings and you hear somebody softly say, oh Lord, he's coming. And then they're like, just throw in the French fries, throw in the chicken wings, put on Hall of the Mountain King. This is a very weird diner we're describing. But anyway, you're right. You're right. This is what happened. They made the first fast food supply chain, and we'll have to explore that in this or a future episode. This was objectively impressive. Not necessarily good for the world, but objectively impressive. It's kind of like when Henry Ford choked down his anti-Semitism just long enough to really figure out the assembly line. Like he took an afternoon off and focused on something else for like just a second. And now we have the assembly line, and the fast food operation was very, very much like this at White Castle. And they even had a specialized wing of the company dedicated just to building White Castles so that they could make sure every building looked kind of the same. And today there's a guy you may have heard of, Ray Kroc, K-R-O-C. He gets a lot of attention for doing the same thing with McDonald's through something they call the Speedy Service System, S-P-E-E-D-E-E.
Crucial branding there.
Right, crucial branding. And that's, I don't know if I wouldn't call it a ripoff, but it's definitely heavily inspired by and built upon what White Castle had already been doing back in the 20s and 30s. That standardization, that is the hallmark of modern fast food. But that's fast food history, and there's nothing necessarily conspiratorial about that today. It's just a pattern of people wanting faster solutions to the problem of, I don't have enough time. So that problem is still with people in 2021. What does it mean? What does it mean now? Is fast food a fad, you guys?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think it's become like ingrained in our very culture, like we were talking about earlier, by in many ways by necessity. I mean, you know, the area of town here in Atlanta that I live in is what you would call a food desert, where there are very few fresh produce, you know, stores. I mean, there's a Publix and there's Kroger, but they're a good 10-minute drive away. And if you don't have a vehicle and you're just on foot, the immediate area where I live, it's largely populated with gas stations and fast food joints. So, it really is kind of, potentially nefarious, you know, and opportunistic, because some areas that have less development and are maybe seen as being a little more dangerous, you know, by the powers that be, you're not going to see as much development of those types of restaurants. But fast food joints, they look at that as an opportunity.
Yeah, fast food is a leviathan because it directly addresses one of the fundamental needs of existence for human beings. And it is profitable despite a global pandemic. Actually, fast food did pretty well during the pandemic. Global fast food revenue right now is greater than $570 billion. For comparison, when we talked about advertising in a past episode, that global revenue ran into about 300 something, around about 350-ish, $360 billion. Fast food dwarfs that. And the U.S. fast food industry alone, their revenue is about $110 billion a year. And we have people who work in the fast food service and associated service industries listening to the show today, rightly thinking $110 billion a year. Where is all that money going, right? Because it's certainly not going to me and my coworkers. That is another problem with fast food. Here's a statistic that I think I read the book that cites this statistic, and I originally didn't believe it, but it does check out. If you live in the United States, 90% of children in your country between the age of 3 and 9 go to McDonald's at least once a month.
Yeah, it's just to get the new toy.
The Happy Meal. Oh, man, I love them. I love them. They still let you buy those if you're an adult, but, you know, you get some looks. The move is to pretend you have a kid at home.
Yeah, but you're right. The reason why we're even bringing that up is because it sounds pretty crazy. That's a lot of McDonald's eating at least once a month, right? For 90% of children, because there are a lot of kids. And I wonder if it, yeah, anyway, we don't have to get into some of the stuff that I want to talk about right now. Let's continue going down this line.
So that book is Fast Food Nation, The Dark Side of the All-American Meal by an author named Eric Schlosser. Highly recommend it. You should be able, it's been used as a textbook in colleges, which, why am I bringing that up? That means that there are going to be a lot of very inexpensive copies of that book. So, because a lot of people just got rid of it when they were done with school. And so we'll pause for a moment for a word from our sponsors to give you time to read the book in its entirety.
And we're back. How about that book? Good job. Y'all are some speed readers out there.
pardon the helicopter in the background there, folks, as well. I don't know if anybody can hear it, but we're not in an ideal sound setup at this moment, at least on my end. But we are in reach of fast food, because there are very few places in the U.S. that are not in reach of fast food, or very few places where humans habitually live that don't have some kind of fast food outlet near them. As a matter of fact, as of 2019, all of the top 10 fast food brands in the world come from the good old U.S. of A. We're not just talking the McDonald's. We're talking the Starbucks. We're talking the Subways. Subway, by the way, has the highest amount of physical locations across the planet. Mm-hmm.
More than McDonald's. Yeah, it makes sense, because they seem to find their ways into places like Walmart's and other larger stores. Why is there a Subway here? I find myself saying that all the time.
Or the Pentagon. That happened once, but they closed it, I think.
I wonder how that deal works. You're right, though. There always are Subways in Walmart stores and no others. That's really, really interesting. I didn't realize, Ben, you found this amazing stat about the three largest companies, one of which is a Chinese holding company, that deal in fast food. McDonald's, Starbucks, and Yum China Holdings, which hold the market caps in the business. McDonald's being number one with $144.6 billion, Starbucks being number two with $88.3 billion, and Yum China Holdings with $19.7 billion. And that one is really fascinating to me because I looked it up and they, you know, they have a lot of like traditional kind of more like Chinese hot pot type places that you'd only find in Asia. But they obviously cornered the market and bought the franchise rights to Pizza Hut and Taco Bell. And if you
and KFC, you look, don't forget KFC,
excuse me, which is huge in Asia, as we know, right? Ben, we did an episode on Ridiculous History about the mythologized, got that out of Colonel Sanders in Japan in particular, and like it was a whole thing.
There was even Christmas like, meal.
Christmas meal, that's what it was, Ben. Thank you. But I love this. If you go to Yum China Holder, it's ir.yumchina.com, and you can look at their brands. Pizza Hut. I love the story behind Pizza Hut. It says Pizza Hut is the leading casual dining restaurant brand in China as measured by system sales. It started from humble beginnings over 60 years ago when the Carney brothers borrowed $600 from their mom and set out to change the way the world experiences pizza. Pizza Hut came to China and Beijing in 1990, and now there are over 2,400 Pizza Hut restaurants in over 500 cities. But it literally was the thing that introduced fast casual American kind of pizza dining to Asia.
I mean, Pizza Hut, I know we are going to we're going to say some disturbing and true things about fast food in general in this two-part series, but thanks for Book It, Pizza Hut. Thanks for thanks for giving me the free pizzas and the books,
dude. It was worth it. You know, cheese conspiracy aside, Book It made it worth it.
Oh, and then what let's see what else. Yes, cheese conspiracy. Oh, I guess what I should say is thank you, Yum Brands, because they're one of those companies that owns a bunch of things like fingers on a hand that seem to compete with each other until you realize they all go back. Gosh, but that's it is true. And speaking of that, by the way, a market cap, if anyone's confused, is the total dollar value of a company's stock shares. That's how big McDonald's is. That's how big Starbucks and Yum China are. They're leviathans. They're behemoths. Number four, by the way, and just like any other sort of corporate list, number one is outsized. Number three is a distant third. And number four here is smaller comparatively, but still in the billions. This, I thought, was interesting. It's a company, an outfit called Darden Restaurants, and they're just like the way, Noel, you described Yum. They own a ton of stuff you might have thought of as separate companies. You're driving down a street, a main street in any town USA, and you see the Olive Garden, you see the Longhorns, you might see the Yard House, and you might think those are owned by different people. They're not. It's all the same company at the top. It's all Darden. And Darden used to be part of something even bigger. It used to be part of General Mills.
Wow. Which,
yeah, I know. This goes all the way to the top of the cereal box.
Wait a second. Is Applebee's a subsidiary of some other company too?
No comment.
No.
You know, guys, I had one good comedy idea years and years ago when I was like in like elementary school. We were doing like a talent show and I didn't really, it was just an idea with nothing to back it up really, but it was General Mills 90210, where it was going to be just different cereals, yeah, like in a high school kind of like romance type situation.
Oh, that's great. It
didn't really have any further development from that, but I will always remember that idea, General Mills 90210.
Let's make it. Let's film the, you know, the way you get around that and keep it as a sketch, man, is we just film it as a trailer for the new season. As long as it's not season one, let's get real. It's like season four. Yes. Okay. We're sorry, fellow conspiracy realists, please let us do that one because it was Noel's idea. So don't take it from us. And don't take it from us the way McDonald's took White Castle's idea, which they totally did.
Well, but it's one of those things where is that really an idea that one can own, right? I mean, it's sort of like, Can you really own the wind? You know, I mean, can you own standardization of food service? It's certainly they were the first one to do it, but it's hard to trademark or copyright a process like that.
You know, that's an interesting argument. It goes against preserving your awesome sketch idea.
That's pure intellectual property, and I have trademarked that with the Library of Congress already. So,
all right,
hands off.
Let's see if we can patent sketch comedy. So today, the U.S. also, in addition to having the world's most successful fast food brands, it has the world's largest fast food industry. You can find American fast food restaurants in well over 100 countries, and it touches on geopolitics in a really weird way. Have you guys ever heard the idea that it's called the Golden Arches Doctrine? Have you ever heard the idea that if two countries both have McDonald's, they will not go to war?
Interesting. Like by some sort of secret pact, or just sort of by the fact that it represents something culturally?
Well, it's the idea that it represents some cultural or capitalist commonality.
Got it. That's fascinating.
Yeah, the idea here is that this was first proposed by an economist who isn't perfect, named Thomas Friedman. It was called the Golden Arches Theory of Conflict Prevention. And his argument said people who live in McDonald's countries, as he called them, don't like to fight wars. They like to wait in line for burgers. And his real argument was that if you're a country that has a middle class large enough to sustain something like that, they've reached a level of prosperity that makes war risky and unpalatable. However, I'm only bringing this up to completely bust it, to debunk it, because look at the Kosovo War. Those countries involved there had McDonald's. But if you want to learn more about this idea that has been debunked, do check out his book, The Lexus and the Olive Tree. Anyway.
That's a really interesting idea. I would say it probably has more to do with kind of what you said there. And again, I'm not an economist. This guy's probably very much right. For me, it would be more about the supply chain that we've been describing here, where in order to have a McDonald's, you probably have a pretty good trade agreement with another country. Maybe it's, you know, but again, that would only be if we're talking about war with the United States and or, you know, whichever country, like let's say it's McDonald's China, maybe yeah, so you know what? I just poked holes in my own argument. Let's forget it.
No. I think the best way to say it is it hinges on one's definition of war, right? The concept of war is changing as well.
I thought war never changes. I don't know. All right.
Well, it didn't until the most recent upgrade. You have to install the update. Did you install your war update?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, I think we're at 3.0 now, bud.
Yeah.
Dang.
Keep up. Keep up with war updates. Jeez. So the reason I bring this up is it's kind of a setup for part two of our series here. Thomas Friedman is not correct in his assertion that countries can be prevented from open warfare just because they like the same fast food. But it is true that fast food has a much larger, much more profound, and perhaps much more insidious effect on economies than people might believe, on economies and on culture, and ultimately on human beings. In some situations, fast food actually seems economically bulletproof. We mentioned at the top of today's episode the coronavirus, the COVID-19 pandemic, millions and millions and millions of businesses, little mom and pop places, had to close. They were forced out. They had to shutter their doors, even in countries that provided economic assistance. Not like the U.S., not like countries that pretended to provide economic assistance to mom and pop places, but countries that actually did. That still wasn't enough for a lot of people. And the opposite was true for fast food places. Just like Matt said earlier, the idea of buying something prepackaged was in terms of fast food, it was seen as healthier, more sanitary. You minimized your interaction with people by going to a drive-thru.
That's true, but also, like, I mean, you know, fast food workers are handling things, and there is potential for, you know, sneezes and such. So to me, there was still some consternation around that at first, I think. But then people kind of warmed up to the idea, realized things weren't maybe transmitted as much over surfaces. I don't know. It's a weird one that they were able to dodge that. I would have personally thought, given that maybe some of these restaurants maybe do take some shortcuts here and there, that people maybe would have been a little more cautious, but apparently that wasn't the case.
I would say it goes back to standardizing things, right? So I'm imagining, and I saw this in real time, that the standardizing of safety procedures occurred across, let's say, McDonald's. My family went to McDonald's while we were, locked down pretty heavily, and it felt really safe. When you're just observing it, right? I have no idea what exactly is happening back in the kitchen there. But, you know, according to all the signage, according to what I'm seeing the employees wearing, what they're doing, it felt very safe. And then you imagine that that's being spread out across the franchises as much as possible.
Very quickly and very methodically. No, and you're right. And they would have been the first types of companies to institute mask mandates for all of their employees instantly, because they needed to not lose that confidence in the public. They needed people to feel comfortable, or else they could have lost their bottom line very quickly.
That is a fantastic point. You know, that's a profound point, because the infrastructure, the communications, the logistics were already there. These outfits already probably had a clear, supply chain opportunity for things like masks. So here's another problem with this, though. The folks who worked for these companies in these situations throughout the pandemic, they were called essential workers, or they were called heroes, because calling them heroes was a hell of a lot easier than treating them like human beings or helping them survive. You know what I mean? You can, make no mistake, the same people who were posting stuff on social media, at least in several instances, the same people who were posting stuff on social media saying, here are the real heroes, were probably treating those folks like they were not human. When it came to the drive-thru, why did I have to wait so long for my number three? You know what I mean? I ordered the small chicken nuggets. It's basically you and Hitler, you monstrous cashier at the drive-thru. That's where we are. Like, because, you know, people are very, very self-centered. So what we're saying, the reason this pandemic example is so important, is because we see a situation which the workers were struggling, the customers were struggling, and the fast food outfit, the company itself, the capital C company, continued doing well. It thrived. So that's an interesting situation, isn't it? Because usually for a business to have to do well, the customers would have to be doing okay. The employees would probably be, I don't know. Maybe the employees don't always have to do well for a company to do well. Actually, they don't. That's true. I talked myself out of my own point there.
We keep doing that.
We keep doing that. But in short, fast food has been around a long, long time. It has only grown. It continues to do so. There's a very quick, here's where it gets crazy for today's episode. And it's this. You needed to know the history of how we got here today to know exactly what is going crazy, how it's going crazy, and why it's going crazy now and in the future. So tune in for part two of this series, where we're going to talk a little bit more about the present and the future, the allegations true and untrue about the fast food industry at large. Assuming, of course, we don't get pulled by Big Fast?
Yeah, no, Big Fast might get us.
Big Fast? Okay. Is there someone named Big Fast?
Yeah. Just like your favorite fast food chain, this episode is a combo meal. You just have to wait, a while before you get the second part. The fries are coming later. Or maybe this was the fries. You're going to get your chicken sandwich, whichever one you like the best, because now everybody's got a competing chicken sandwich. It's coming next week.
And speaking of things on the way, we've got part two of this series on the way to you. In the meantime, we'd like you to have something on the way to us. What is, if you made a fast food restaurant, what would it be? What would it serve? What do you think about fast food during the pandemic? What do you think about the way people working at those jobs were treated during the pandemic? We want to hear from you. We try to make it easy to find us online.
That's right. You can find us on the internet in the usual social media places of note. We are Conspiracy Stuff on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. On YouTube, you can find daily video clips from each of our daily podcast episodes to enjoy. While you're at it, on the internet, why not pop over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a nice review? We would really appreciate it. It helps our discoverability for new listeners and, you know, just makes us feel good in our little hearts. You can also, whilst on the internet, find us on Instagram at Conspiracy Stuff Show.
And if you don't like doing that, you can use that rectangular thing in your hand and call us with your mouth. It's weird, but
yeah, it starts with your fingers and then ends up with the mouth.
Hey Siri, yeah, speak for yourself.
No, literally, speak for yourself at our call in line.
Well, no, it works in all the levels, Ben. Excellent work. Our number is 1-833-STD-WYTK. You have 3 minutes to leave a message after you hear Ben's voice. Please give yourself a cool nickname, whatever you want it to be, just so we're not shouting out your real name over the internet. It's probably a smart move. If you got anything personal you want to say to us, please leave it right at the end if possible. And if you've got more to say than you can fit in that 3 minutes, go ahead and shoot us a good old-fashioned email. You can put anything you want in there. We are
Conspiracy@iHeartRadio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.